The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to episode 28 of Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and technique.
We got something slightly different this time though. So we speak to Jonathan Simons, who is behind the Analog C Review. So we speak to him in his capacity as a publisher, but he is also a writer, a singer-songwriter, and done a bit of translation.
Yeah. So we kind of touched on that at the start of the conversation, but mainly about the process of coming up with Analog C.
Which is quite a concept behind it, which really you would think, 30 years ago, this isn't such a massive concept. But it's a completely offline publication, so he's trying to also highlight work that encourages you to exist in that more contemplative state, and to just take a bit of time to not be online and to be bombarded,
which I think is increasingly difficult these days as we talk about in the podcast. But
well, so we'll listen to Jonathan.
Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I guess if we start maybe by talking about when you sort of first started writing seriously.
Sure. Well, that was always happening for me. I did work in universities, so I was doing academic writing and research, but also creative writing. I mean, poetry goes back to when I was a little kid, so pretty much always doing that. And then writing songs and working as a touring singer-songwriter was something I did for about 15 years. And then the decision to start the press, Analog C, came after I realized that the digital revolution had pretty much decimated the music industry. I had one concert tour in 2015, and there was over 100,000 streams on Spotify. And then I got my PayPal transfer from the digital distributor for $11. And then I realized that something isn't quite right.
Yeah.
And at that time, I had finished, my first collection of poems, which I had spent about 10 years working on, and was in discussion with some small presses in England. But, their idea, of course, was to do a print-on-demand book. Which is not a bad thing at all. I mean, it's great to have things in print, but for me, that felt anticlimactic. I really wanted to see my poems in a really stunning physical object. So that's where some of the ideas for Analog C came from.
Hmm. And while you were working as a songwriter, did you feel that the poetry, the fiction writing was a separate endeavor, or was it kind of something that was connected to songwriting?
For me, it's always been connected. I mean, I would separate academic writing. That's tends to be a sort of different part of my brain that's being tapped.
Was that a sort of literary related academic writing, or?
It was both. I was doing research and writing on Buddhist poetics, but that was strictly research writing. And then some creative writing when I was, I did a master's at University of Edinburgh, focusing on literary criticism. Modern stuff. I would say though that when I write essays, like the essays that I write nowadays for Analog C, or when I introduce our interviews and things like that, definitely comes from a similar part of my brain as poetry. But I think that for me, musicality is just really, really important. And that certainly comes from the fact that I've been playing music my whole life, I think.
Musicality in the sort of the rhythm of the words and the flow of the prose.
Yeah, it's just very high up on the list of for me what ends up feeling like good writing.
And is that what you'd say separates academic writing, that it doesn't? I mean, that's not a concern.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why sometimes academic translations, I think, miss the mark, because the idea is accuracy, not musicality. So when you're translating ancient poetry for academics, you know, you need it to convey all the important, you know, information from an anthropological perspective. But what about the musicality that tends to get lost?
Yeah, it's not. I've not read many academic translations of ancient poetry, but I think, you know, that must be a good point that it is written for to be picked over in a way that fiction generally isn't in right. general use.
Yeah. Well, subtlety, you know, subtlety is important, but subtlety isn't only logic. It's also aesthetics. It's feeling. So how do you convey the subtleties of feeling? I mean, that's the whole point of, I think, the arts and letters, you know, and there's a whole spectrum. I mean, journalism can be very, very poetic, but often the primary point of a journalistic piece is to convey information. The primary point of a poem is to convey a feeling that journalism or some sort of more logical text just would fail at doing. So different types of subtlety.
Yeah. So you also do some translation as well as writing. I assume you speak other languages.
I fumble through my desperate attempts to speak other languages. In the new issue, there's a piece by Guy Debord, who is the French philosopher who wrote The Society of the Spectacle. We talk a lot about him in this issue. And there was a piece where we couldn't find a translation that felt right to us. So with a little help from my friends, I did translate that short piece, but it takes me a long time. So I have a lot of respect for translators that can do really quality work without taking, I don't know, 100 hours like I did, maybe.
I assume Guy Debord could be quite tricky to translate with a lot of flow. Or maybe I've read fairly stilted translations previously.
It's interesting. Well, he's someone, again, that I, from my research, his translations have been done mainly, you know, by academics. Because, you know, he's, you know, appreciated in several different faculties of the academy, but it's the humor, I think. I mean, he was whimsical in his writing and in his philosophy. And then, you know, I think that's something that gets missed.
Mm-hmm. Like it's drained out of
exactly.
the translations.
So, going back to Analog C, we should maybe for listeners, if you're able to sort of give, description of how it came about from right. So you had the collection of poems and there was the option to go and print on demand, but
right.
you felt there was somewhere better to go.
Yeah. Well, I guess the idea was to establish an offline press. And, you know, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that we don't touch the internet or we don't use email. It means a few different things. It means that if you hear about one of our editions, you need to go buy it from a bookstore. You have to look someone in the eye and say, I'd like a copy of Analog C Review number 2, please. And then, so the idea of Amazon and online shopping, I have to be very careful and say it's not explicitly a bad thing. But it's oriented around convenience and, you know, sort of we're in the throes of neoliberalism, which is, you know, capitalism and convenience coming together and making kind of an interesting situation or, you know, kind of disrupting a lot of things. So you have to buy it from a bookshop. And then the other thing is we're trying to make exquisite editions, you know, just the best possible quality that we can muster. So that's another important thing.
Mm-hmm. And was it relatively easy to get that process up and going to publish? I presume you'd not published anything before that point, you know, made a physical.
I haven't myself. No, I've had my own work published by others, but I hadn't. Yes. Yeah, so this does represent my sort of entryway into the literary world as a publisher. Well, to be very honest, I really didn't think that we were going to succeed. But 2.5 years later, I can say with a lot of pride and appreciation from the other writers and editors around me that we have succeeded thus far. I mean, we could talk about what that means or whatever, but I don't think it has been that hard. I mean, making editions that are product of craft, sort of a slow publishing kind of perspective. Yeah, that's difficult. You know, that takes a lot of time. So we really put all of ourselves into what we've done so far. But in terms of gaining the attention of people that would appreciate this kind of work, I have to say that hasn't been so hard.
Mm. Did it take a few iterations to find the sort of format or the I mean, I guess you had a collection of poems, but
right.
when did it become something beyond a one-off publication and a series?
I would say the act of creating editions is very similar to the act of writing. So there's always, you know, this figuratively, but there's always this sense of places that can be deepened, you know, things that can get refined. It's like a landscape of rough edges. And then you just go around and try to smooth out or enlighten certain areas around you. And that's true when it comes to the editing process of a text, but also making a book, in our case, the literary journal. So we were always refining different aspects. And I think the second issue is definitely leaps and bounds more a success than the first issue. So yeah, absolutely. We learn by trial and error. But I do think that just after two issues, I think that we pretty much have our format that we feel really proud about.
So this is number two that we have in front of us. Obviously, yep. Not good for the listening media. Right. But did that come out last year? Is that sort of 2019?
Yep.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So you must be sort of in the process of pulling together and putting to bed number yep. three.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yep. And you've, as you say, you sort of got the format that's, mm-hmm. that's set up from before. It's obviously a very attractive looking thing as an item in the world. With the artwork and things like that, is that along the same ethos? I mean, are you looking for sort of visual artists and stuff to get involved with it who buy into the same principles?
Yeah. I don't enjoy putting it into a box, but, you know, more or less, this is kind of neo-romanticism in a way. Again, it doesn't mean that some of the more modern writing or some of the hyper-realism that we see a lot of these days is better or worse than what we're doing. But yeah, I think whether it's the typography, the cover aesthetic, or, you know, the writing itself, I think that it's not so modern. You know, it has a certain romantic quality to it, which, of course, I like.
And there's sort of connections to, from what I was reading, the sort of the marketing literature about it, as far as that goes, about relationships to nature and people who want to take themselves off the digital world and sort of immerse themselves. Now that you're getting on to issue three, you find that the people are writing kind of with that as a specification, using it as the chance to have an experience to produce some writing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we talk about our interest in hearing from writers who are, you know, not glued to the screens all day long. You know, so, you know, what does it mean? I mean, we're all of the age where we know what the Sunday afternoon feeling, you know, is like, that where time stretches out and one can go really deep into, complicated literature or into writing. And so, we're on the opposite end of the spectrum of, you know, insta poetry or flash fiction. Mm. We're really into craft and what, strong faculties of attention can actually produce, you know, in a human being.
And is that something that's developed as you've sort of been working and building up Analoxy, or were those concerns that were kind of integral to your first collection of poetry? How did it come about that it wasn't just another collection of fiction and poetry? And I mean, there's plenty of beautifully produced books out there that have great writing in them, but they don't make any distinction between the online and offline world. They'll have Twitter accounts, Instagram followers or whatever, but you've made a very conscious decision, I think, to not be online. When did that come about, and what sort of
that was at the beginning it? Even the conception of the name Analoxy, I mean, that's the idea. You know, a press that's interested in how people document their contemplative time, it doesn't mean that we're have anything to do with the new age, right? And it doesn't mean that we're only publishing you know, work from people that go on retreats or something. It's not like that at all. I mean, actually, I think that the most interesting aspect of contemplative life is what I call the contemplative gap. These are the accidental moments that one has in between things, where one thinks, where one dreams, you know. So you have a very busy, active life. Maybe you have a family, but there's 5 minutes where you're walking from your office door to your car door, and that's the contemplative gap. Mm. And if you fill that up, all of those accidental contemplative moments, then where are you? And what are you saying? You know, what do you have to say? Mm. So the idea of giving a voice to people that are fighting to maintain a contemplative life, even in the most urban, environments, is kind of what we're interested in. So that may be ruminations on nature, but not exclusively. I mean, Guy Debord talks about the derive and how one can have a poetic experience in a city like Paris. So it's not ecological writing or nature per se, but that's part of it.
I mean, it's interesting the way that balances with how I think the majority of people maybe do live their lives now. And thinking about the fact that people will probably be listening to this on smartphones or through their laptops, which is maybe less distracting. But the idea that for a lot of people now, I think they wake up and immediately grab their phone and see all the gaps
disappear in a day quite easily.
You've got something in your pocket that is always a distraction from your own mental space and from just, yeah.
Right, but it's mediating so much that we're not really being as critical, you know, about the tools as we should. And it's difficult for all of us to be critical about the things that we're very much, you know, sort of intertwined with. It's easier, you know, the hippies could critique everyone over 30 because they were all under 30. But what do you do when balance or health has to do with critiquing the things that are important to you? I mean, we're all addicted to this stuff, including myself. The question is, how addicted are we? If one is a little bit addicted to their smartphone and that red flashing, you know, notification number, then you win the game. You have the best of both worlds. But if it's filling up all of those, what I call those contemplative gaps, all of that accidental time where you fall into these sort of basic existential questions that really fuel individuation, then hopefully something like Analog C or, you know, what I'm saying now might give someone pause.
And was that something you found you were addicted at before starting this process? Or did you have to kind of fight to get rid of a smartphone rid of all these distractions? Or was it something that you'd been sort of building to for a while? And
This is where I can make my very private, confidential confessional. I was one of these ridiculous human beings, like quite many of us, who waited in line at an Apple store to buy, in my case, the first iPhone. This was 2006 or 7 in Portland, Oregon, and then they escort you in, you know, to give you, you know, after you've been waiting for an hour in line, and then they applaud you, they clap for you. So I have been validated by Apple as a good consumer. And I had the first iPhone, and I was walking around Montreal. I moved from Portland to Montreal like a zombie, texting and whatnot. And then I got to a certain point where I really started to notice how it was affecting, I would say, my freedom to think. I noticed that it felt like the center of my world was inside the machine as opposed to inside the void that is where we come from and where we're going. And that felt very unnerving to me. And
was there a specific moment that you remember sort of having a realization of, I need to break this thing in half? Or was it more of a slow realization?
I think it was a slow realization. I mean, when I got the $11 check from PayPal from all my efforts on my tour in 2015, that was a very concise moment of like, something's not right here. But in terms of the smartphone, well, when I moved to Europe about 10, 11 years ago, I just didn't get one. So now in my case, you know, in our editorial office, we use the internet quite a lot, for all sorts of different things, but I have no internet at home. So for me, this strikes the right balance. And I have, when I'm, you know, not too busy with other things, I have, you know, what I call romantic evenings of self. I run around, I chase around my books, and I write, and I do my research and stuff at home without distraction. But I have a telephone, so people call me and they interrupt me, and then we have a conversation on the phone. I think each one of us just needs to take a step back and understand, like, what do we really want to be doing with our free time? How do we want to be developing? You know, time is the most valuable natural resource we have. What do we want to do with it?
Because it's interesting with the thing you were saying about addiction earlier. I was thinking about how, with your phone, it's all about the little reward centers and everything, isn't it? As much as the apps are designed to be convenient for us and to help us be connected, there's a kind of a gamification of it that's a little pat on the head the more you interact with it. And with things like television as well, with Netflix and everything like that, it's designed to just keep you coming back and going there. So when you were talking about the way that music as well online has become a thing whereby streaming is just decimating the money that people could make from it or to make a career out of it without touring.
Yeah.
It's sort of interesting that that has been very unsuccessful with books as far as I understand. I mean, I think Amazon have tried to do a sort of Spotify with books sort of thing, but maybe just the crossover of the markets just aren't there.
There's different ways you could go into that topic. I mean, for one, you have things like, should I say the name of it? You have certain websites where you can go and get, you know, the vast majority of books as a PDF within seconds, anonymously, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that time will tell. I think we're still in the middle of this stuff, how the digital revolution is going to affect the printed word. We published Will Self's essay, the Written Word in Peril. We reprinted that in Analexia number 2, and he's pretty concerned. It depends what you're, where you look at it. I mean, there's a lot of academics studying how the complexity of writing changes. And they look at many different, metrics. I mean, not only the length of sentences, Hemingway wrote in short sentences, but they also look at the breadth of vocabulary, and they look at, how punctuation is being used, and they try to deduce whether the literature that people are, buying and reading is getting less complex, and they're saying it's getting much, much less complex.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, arguably what's most popular in the literary world are, some of these startups that send you little snippets of classic literature as a text. So every morning you get, 50 words of Tolstoy or whatever.
Yeah. Which is, it's an interesting thought. One, on the one hand, obviously as a reader, to be reading something like Analog C instead of looking at your iPhone or your smartphone is it quite a big shift? I think for a lot of people, finding time to just sit down and read a physical book is something that's difficult these days. But then in terms of the content in Analog-C and in literature generally these days, that what is happening to the topics people write about and the way they write about it is a different question. And I guess that contemplative gap talking about is also related to how people think about it. It's not just the quantity of contemplative gaps, but how they all sum together to create an idea and how that idea is then translated. If you're spending a lot of time thinking about something, then you're going to probably think about it a lot deeper than somebody who might have that idea and then turns their iPhone, jots it down and forgets about it, comes back to it. It's a different structure within the brain, I would imagine. And,
yeah, absolutely.
What that means for literature, I guess it's an open-ended question in terms of where it goes. But I think it's interesting, things like Analog-C that are trying to look at writing that is a bit slower, maybe, I don't know. Right. It's not so focused on short sentences and hooks and making an impact immediately, but
I think that the kinds of changes in the literary world that the internet brings us are some of them are very interesting. I mean, the idea that a person publishes a book based upon their Instagram captions, that idea in itself is not a bad idea. But if that's all we have, then we have a problem on our hands.
Yeah.
So it's to say what we might be losing is not to denigrate what we're gaining, but just to say we need both. In the same way that I think that slam poetry can be very interesting, I just hope we don't only have slam poetry.
Yeah.
And I hope we don't only have Insta poetry. Yeah. I hope we have both. I hope we can benefit from the digital tools in the way you could have some very, very, you know, innovative literary projects online because of the ability to update things and have multimedia. That's pretty interesting. But we also need people sitting in an empty room, reconciling the fact that we don't know why we were born. We don't know where we're going. We're all lost and we're all going to die. And we really need there to be people that are going through that and without distraction, without the candy of, they love me, they love me, they love me, they love me. And, you know,
yeah.
And writing literature about it.
Yeah. And people that are capable and willing to kind of receive that sort of literature, I think, yes. As well. A readership that aren't all glued to smartphones as well.
Right.
Well, I guess the issue you may get is like with having something that is so nicely packaged mm-hmm. is that people then track it down to take really well lit shots on Instagram of them holding the book, walking around, or right. It's often like women's legs with a book and a sort of cup of hot chocolate or something next to it, though it seems to be.
Hilarious. Actually, I have an anecdote to speak to that. There was a certain publicist in the UK who was curious to know whether people would be interested in this on the sort of social networking, and she asked what people thought, and then we noticed that a response was, well, the books are very Instagrammable. so we have arrived. Our books are Instagrammable. And, you know, you don't need to go, you know, into Wigmore to hear music or, you know, into the museum to see anything. Just take a snapshot of yourself outside and,
job's done.
Been there, done.
You've had that experience.
Yeah, take exactly. It up. No, I think it's all fine.
But you take it quite far with the offline thing mm-hmm. in terms of the website that you have is essentially please send a letter or right. a postcard to these two addresses.
Yeah.
Are you doing that slightly with a sort of, I don't know if a raised eyebrow is what I'm after, but you sort of, is that done in a sort of knowing way that's helps to people buy in from the start to what you're doing?
I think there's many reasons why we do it. I mean, we're interested in people that are willing to sacrifice, I don't know, maybe 120 seconds walking down the street to a bookshop to pick up a book. I think that the internet, you know, books being distributed online, there's a lot of great advantages to that. You can find, you know, things that are hard to find. But I just don't think that we should press a button and a drone drops us a book, you know, onto our sofa. In other words, I think the internet is really hyper-commodifying the book. So ultimately, we're not trying to reach everyone. And the fact that the internet makes, you know, even teenagers who learn, you know, how to do really good makeup that, you know, they want to go viral. Or like, you know, you have like a little kid, he's like 4 years old and he's painting and he holds it up and he says, Mommy, can we get funding for this? You know, should we do a Kickstarter campaign for my, you know, for my hand paintings? Yeah. I mean, I'm being silly, but I mean, we're not trying to conquer the world. And this has worked for us because people send us a letter in the mail. We don't publish an email address, and we've gotten thousands of letters in the mail. And I'll tell you, those readers end up being really loyal and interested and supportive. It's incredible, honestly.
Do you think there's a link between the act of writing a physical letter as opposed to writing an email and the process of yeah. getting involved in more and deeper literature? Maybe that's yeah. not so instant.
Yeah. Well, I think engaging, you know, an empty page, it's sort of, it mediates the contemplative experience, you know, as much as the smartphone mediates an online relationship. So, there's tons of people that write us that say they haven't done so in years.
Yeah. I mean, any letter I've written for, I don't know how long, other than for administrative purposes, to an organization or something, but in terms of actual human communication, it's not a medium that I used recently because it is just always so much easier and quicker with email, but it is a different process to sit down with a pen and paper as opposed to firing off an email.
We, you know, Silicon Valley, they're all those business models are based on the idea of removing friction, you know, as if, you know, the more friction we can eliminate, the better, but we need friction. You know, the best example of friction is boredom. You eliminate boredom, the discomforts of boredom. And you will have an individual that doesn't have the time and space to sort of struggle into inspiration or to develop longing or empathy. I mean, if you're hyperstimulated at every hour of every day, then, you know, what's going on?
Yeah. I guess it's coming back to the addiction thing. You're then, you kind of become used to that. That as soon as anything drops slightly, you're not in a good state because you expect this level of stimulation.
Right.
To be constant.
Yeah. And so, you know, to write a letter is inefficient compared to email. And email is inefficient compared to, what's the one where the photo disappears? Snapchat or whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. And, I don't know. Snapchat is inefficient compared to just grunting into a microphone. So, you know, it's just how efficient should we be? An acquaintance of mine said to me a couple of years ago, you don't have a smartphone. And she was kind of almost irritated that I didn't. She goes, how are you able to be efficient? And I just thought to myself, like, is that the point of life? You know, I guess we want that, but there's more to it than that.
Do remember to like, rate, subscribe. Like, rate, subscribe. Like, rate, subscribe.
Do you have any particular routine? Do you have a way of beginning or ending?
Yeah. Well, I'm chasing around inspiration the best I can. I'm perplexed and amazed by the writers who sit down every day at a certain time and they write. I mean, I try to do that too, but the experience of my own writing when I'm not feeling inspired is just absolute, you know, torture. So I guess my routine has a lot to do with carving out the kind of time and space where I know, there's at least a better chance that I'll feel inspired. When I feel inspired, writing is easy. And when I don't feel inspired, writing is horrible. And then, you know, I hope no one will ever read it. So that's pretty, you know, kind of influences my routine. So in that way, the fact that I think, as I mentioned earlier, that I have no internet at home, you know, the technology that I have at home, I have a landline. And then I have all the old technology like pens and paper and my old typewriter and stuff. So for me to be able to get away from all the noise and all of the, you know, administrative burden of this project and to make dinner and then sit down, in a silent room and, try to ease into that sense of spaciousness, then there's at least, you know, a fighting chance that I'll feel inspired and maybe write something that I can tolerate.
Hmm. And when you do write something that you feel has legs and is going somewhere, do you kind of finish it in one burst and kind of that's it done, or do you edit and redraft a lot? Or
when I was a very young writer years ago, I had this, I don't know, maybe from watching or reading Burroughs or watching the film about Burroughs, I was debating about editing, whether one should edit or not. And I just, for some reason, concluded that one shouldn't, that editing was, you know, somehow, inauthentic. And I'm just on the complete opposite end of that idea. I think that for me, editing is just 50% or more of the craft of writing. And for the way I would describe it, as simple as it sounds, is it reminds me a lot of sculpting. You know, so, you know, the initial shape of what I'm writing is perhaps, you know, in one sitting, it's sort of a burst. But then, you know, it has 1,000 rough edges, you know. So from there, the idea is to try to shape it. But that to me is also, it's not an overtly intellectual process, you know, if we're talking about creative writing. Usually I rediscover the inspiration that created the piece, and then and then that informs the editing.
Hmm. It's kind of continuous, you have a draft and then continuously sort of rework that until it's finished.
Yeah, and I really honestly don't think I could ever write, at least in the way that I'm referring to now, I don't think I could ever write like a long book, because the amount of time that I put in, you know, to editing, like the essay now I'm working on is, you know, basically 700 words. And it's just, you know, the amount of time to try to craft the musicality and the flow, you know, the feeling of the text is just really time consuming.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have a sort of ongoing project that you know might take a couple of decades maybe, but something that you just go back to and pick away at?
Yeah. No, I do have some of those, but I don't think I'll ever finish them. I think that's my epic poem. We'll see.
Yeah. The work is the sort of the project rather than...
It's an amazing thing to think about. I mean, in this age of sort of the constant now or liquid modernity, as, you know, Bauman refers to it, you know, the idea of how the history of the epic poem and all the different poets that would write a poem that they would never expect to finish, that the point was not to finish it. In other words, there was no imagination of a readership.
Mm.
It's just the process.
Yeah, which is... the complete opposite of the sort of insta poetry, where the realization of it in a sense is when it has 10,000 likes, or is uh-huh. Is the realization is when it's published readers respond, rather than the process of it in itself, which
exactly
very very different kind of approach to writing in the first place. And one other question in terms of, I guess it's slightly different in that you're not writing longer pieces of fiction, but I mean, one thing I find writing fiction, I'm maybe not looking at my phone, but I'm certainly looking on the internet with however many tabs open, cross-referencing things, reading and just checking things that maybe I didn't need to check, but I do. I mean, I've sometimes it depends what I'm writing, but I might write without going to the internet, but all too often it seems there's something that I need to find out. I go to the internet and down a rabbit hole of research. But do you sort of extend the offline paradigm to not engaging with the internet when you're writing at all, or do you quite a lot of reading around?
Yeah. Well, first of all, on my desk at home, which is an offline environment, I have, you know, all sorts of, you know, reference books. So I have all sorts of tabs open. They're books. And you know, they can pull me into tangents, but only so far. You know, the felt sense of my environment or the boundaries around the space in which I'm working are not that far removed from, you know, the core task or the core passion or, you know, the text. Mm. So again, you know, it's not black and white. It doesn't mean the internet is bad. It doesn't mean the computer is bad. I do a lot of my editing on the computer. I often turn the internet off when I'm working on editing on the computer. And then sometimes I need to do research. And then I use the internet. So again, it's not the medium, it's just the way in which the medium can take us away from ourselves.
Mm. So you have a kind of distinct phase then of you do research during the day in the office.
Exactly.
Take notes from that or get what you need from that, and then have a different period of time at home or a different period in the office without the internet on.
Right.
Where you right.
I think the crux of this is that to have something to say and to not know how to say it, or to have something, to have a feeling and to not know how to understand the feeling or how to express the feeling, these are not uncomfortable situations to be in as a writer. This is precisely why most writers refer to writing as a painful process, or often excruciating process. But, the internet and all the dopamine hits that we can get, the way that we can essentially instantly step into this vast marketplace of distractions, it's takes us away from the discomfort of writing and all the rewards of kind of, you know, wading our way through that discomfort.
Yeah, I think that's right. There is a kind of a sort of flattening, I think, of everything really through the internet. I mean, it's flattening in the sense it's all coming through a small 5-inch screen or whatever, but there's a sort of sense that there's not that much difference between somebody doing poetry on Instagram and somebody telling a makeup line. And in the real sense, there's not. It all comes down to how many likes they got on their post. Whereas in reality, there should be a huge difference between selling makeup and grappling with the mysteries of life and trying to put them into coherent form.
Exactly. I mean, we just have to face it. I mean, the internet has become a toxic place. I mean, the way in which advertising happens now and the surveillance, you know, on our activities online. And then the way socialization happens, you know, it pulls us outside of ourselves a lot. So, you know, again, if one can, be sitting in front of, I don't know, like an array of screens, you know, and you have the strongest connection to the internet ever made, like you're hanging out in the Pentagon or something, I don't know. And then you can maintain focus, you know, including, maintaining a focus on the discomfort that arguably goes into good writing. You know, the basic existential questions and, you know, and all of that. I mean, if you can do that, more power to you. I can't. You know, I'm going to be shopping for shoes like within seconds.
I wonder if some of this comes from, I don't want to make assumptions about our ages or sat around here, but I think we certainly were unlikely to have had digital childhoods, as it were. And the fact that, so I really like when I'm writing to still use a thesaurus as a book. And I find that that takes you off on tangents, but you think about things a different way that just Googling a word, if you want, it's not quite the one you're after. There's a synonym you know's there somewhere. Yeah. But then I think for people who, we didn't have the internet when I was at school, you know, for research, it was never an option to go on to. But if you've grown up with that, the way that your brain works differently and that extra contemplative state, sort of space that exists might just not seem to be there for you. Like your social interactions just are Facebook and things like that, as well as knowing people in real life. I think to a lot of us who grew up before that, that's just like a little thing you can choose to get involved in. That's not actually you, the avatar. So I wonder if in 20 years' time, someone would think up something like the Analog Sea Review because their world is half offline and online. They just feel like it's such an integral thing. They wouldn't think to.
Well, half and half sounds like a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're certainly not advocating for, you know, complete eradication of the internet. I mean, I think if Twitter disappeared, it would be probably okay. But no, I'm just kidding. But
I mean, book Twitter, weirdly, which is the only Twitter I really engage with, seems a reasonably kind place. And because the sort of writing we're interested in and the sort of publishers and writers we're interested in, people seem quite supportive.
But I
can tell that there's a tsunami of hatred and hot takes that I'm choosing to get involved in.
Yeah. And, you know, platforms like Twitter are certainly challenging, you know, our ideas of democracy. But that's a whole other can of worms. I think that there's a lot of people who say that, you know, well, I refer to this as the historicity argument, this idea that, you know, we've always had the desire to escape boredom. Yeah, that's true, but we haven't always been able to do it. Or we've always had the idea to go to war with, you know, the other tribe. Yeah, but we haven't always had, you know, such dangerous weapons. So, I mean, just because the place that we're in now is a product of humanity that goes back 10,000 years since the Agrarian Revolution or more, doesn't mean that we should be complacent. Doesn't mean that we should just accept all of this. So from that standpoint, I think that this is really, a difficult time. I mean, we all know it's a difficult time for democracy and the environment, but, you know, perhaps possibly this is a difficult time for literature too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is in lots of ways that, I mean, the act of creating literature, as talked about, finding the time and space to just think and contemplate and craft the ideas in your head, even before putting them down on paper is one thing. But then, yeah, the sort of socio-technological implications of having Amazon and Google and Facebook, that's another level of I mean, at the moment it's mainly seems to be taking away attention, but those systems are now in place that in the future the control could be given to or taken by different actors.
Right, and the idea that algorithms can write novels is not dystopian. I mean, that's our present. And the idea that algorithms can write journalism, I don't remember the statistic offhand, but there's quite a lot of articles. I think the majority of the journalism that's happening just kind of like in general online, especially where it's like relatively simple local coverage, you know, their algorithms are writing this.
Yeah.
Another small example is that, you know, a sort of financial opportunity for a lot of composers was, you know, having a contract to write music for video games. I'm not a huge fan of video games myself, but great. I mean, you get a contract to write 15 hours, compose 15 hours of music. This, apparently, from what I understand, is it's completely being done by the algorithms now.
I mean, we should refer listeners to episode 27 as well, which is the one prior to this one, likely, where we talked about artificial intelligence producing novels and music as well.
Yeah, I think this is an issue that crops up more and more. Right. I think it's interesting talking about the book as a commodity, because obviously you're, in a sense, fighting against the idea of a book being a commodity and Amazon sort of dominating the marketplace. But in another sense, in kind of conflict with that, the book itself is beautiful looking book that is a commodity.
It is.
Sort of thing, in the way that Apple were very successful in having an iPhone and you queued for hours to get that specific piece of hardware. It is a commodity, and it feels to me that the negative aspect of something being a commodity isn't so much tied to, oh, we should get rid of physical objects and commodities in that sense, but to this sort of algorithmic mentality that we need to consume and need to get commodities somehow. Yeah.
You could have an individual that writes a book and makes one copy and sells it to a museum for a lot of money, or gives it, you know, whatever, sells it to a friend for a dollar, and it's a commodity. But I mean, there's a whole spectrum, you know, between things, you know, and I think what runaway capitalism does is it creates, you know, puts this sort of sticky cloud of massification around things. I think the idea now is whether you're, for many writers and many artists and many people that are developing, I don't know, Angry Birds 12, the app or whatever it may be, the idea is to conquer the world, to reach as many people as possible.
And I think that feeds into publishing, in that,
right?
I mean, most of the authors we've spoken to are from small indie presses that are invariably struggling financially and not able to produce that many authors. They're putting out interesting, innovative writing and literature that does try to tackle these bigger issues, but they're fighting against a publishing industry that's dominated by the girl on a train or the big blockbuster titles that sell in their millions. And that, to me, seems a skewed system that I guess there's always been bestsellers and blockbuster hits, but it seems like traditionally publishing has been more centered around the novels that are exploring ideas, and the novels that are bestsellers, you know, some have been great, some have been forgotten, but they're not the absolute center of the publishing industry, which is something that's changed.
Well, that's what the situation is doing. I mean, Amazon is opening bookstores now that have very few titles, and these are the titles that are selling best, and they have the best terms on. I mean, what is democracy? Is democracy a million different people having the freedom to pick up a microphone and all say together, you know, we're all individuals? Or is it a million different people all saying different things, you know? And I think that are words on a page the same as words on a screen? And I say, no, they're not the same. They're not both bad or both perfect. But I mean, the book has a singularity to it. The printed book has a singularity, and it has a descent. It's not being mediated by, you know, the sort of corporate tethers. I mean, you know, the way, you know, a digital book or a blog may be, you know, you can steal a book if you don't have any money.
But also that you can possess it. And the model seems to be for everything, not just books, but for films and music, that you buy a license to have access to it. And only while that platform that you happen to board it on exists, whereas with what you're doing with the physical book.
Yeah, and people usually don't lend their iPhones and iPads to their neighbors and say, here, I'm going to give you my iPhone for the night. Tuck yourself into bed with this one. It'll change everything. But, you know, I think that the book is can be an object of dissent. I mean, think about the history in this country of the small zine movement. Think about Portland, Oregon and all the anarchist bookshops and book scene. We need, or think about Rosa Parks, when it wasn't random that she sat down on the bus in Montgomery and started, the throes of the civil rights movement. They spent a year secretly outside of the system making printed literature on paper so that when she did it, they were ready, you know, with an alternative bus system to get them to work, et cetera. And so I think that... democracy doesn't mean, you know, we're all buying into Facebook, or we all feel free to buy into Facebook. It means that we all have the freedom to say things and to disseminate literature that we think is important.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of interesting talking about that in this environment as well, because of the way that academics at the moment are getting quite... put in quite a difficult position about the sort of views they express on their social media, while they're at the same time encouraged to engage, but then, they won't get supported if they say something that, academics should be arguing with each other and exploring different viewpoints.
Well, also in the academic world, the kind of the commoditization of learning is something that's been happening over the last sort of two decades or in North America for a lot longer, I guess, but certainly in the UK, it's sort of two decades of change that has, it feels like it has changed what and how academics can talk about topics. But, it's not something that's been explicitly brought down from above, but just in the dynamics of this universities responding to the need to be funded in a different way, the dynamics of the university itself has changed.
It's the private model. I mean, the true public model of education is, sort of diminished. Performance and efficiency.
I think it's possibly a good time to wrap up. Thank you very much for your time, for coming to join us. I think as obviously people can't go on and order a copy in the post, it would be good if you could just tell us, how do people get hold of the Analog Sea Review?
Well, they can go ask their local bookstore, who may or may not stock us. We're certainly not stocked everywhere. I don't know. Can they go to your website and learn about Analog Sea?
We can put up any information. We'll have
information below the episode.
Yeah, underneath the episode,
Can they order it in if they go to a bookshop that doesn't have
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the way this works, other people are using the internet to talk about us, and we're completely happy. I mean, if you guys want to talk about us on your website, that would be great. That's fine.
And people can also write by post. There's a postal address.
Yeah, and it's not so hard to find our mailing address on the internet, I'll say that. but ultimately, that's it, is that when people send us a postcard, we have a... two, soon three small editorial offices. When someone sends us a postcard or a letter, we then send them for free our free publication, which is the Analog Sea Bulletin, which has an interview with one of our stockists. We call that Portrait of a Bookshop. We try to do that twice a year, but it doesn't quite happen quite that fast. But so write us a letter, write us a postcard, and we will send you our bulletin. And then in the bulletin, you'll know all of the great independent bookshops, 140 and growing, where you can get our titles. And then you can go in and see a human being. Have a cup of tea.
And we should also say, I guess quite a few writers listen to the podcast as well. I mean, are you actively looking for new writing? And if so, any topics or what should people say?
Always. We always are. We're very open to submissions, and we reply to everybody. We do publish a certain amount of submissions in the journal, and we would absolutely love to hear from people.
Well, thank you to Jonathan for joining us, and thank you for listening. We would ordinarily, obviously, put any of his social media accounts under this episode, but there are none. There is an address on their website. They have a website. to which you could write if you want more information. I'd encourage you to do so. You'll get a free copy of the Analog C Bulletin and just find out more about what they do. I think that would be...
Yeah, and for any writers listening, as we mentioned in the podcast, you could submit writing to Analog C.
Absolutely. But find out what they do first, I would say.
Yeah.
You can find out online more about me and my writing at jamiebatchin.com or at jamiebatchin on Twitter or at jamie_batchin on Instagram, where I'm obviously a deluded influencer.
I've not got round to the Insta poetry yet. I'm on Twitter at Lachlan Bloom or online at lachlanbloom.com.
And you can find out about this podcast at unsoundmethods.co.uk or we're on Twitter at unsoundmethods. I feel like I'm sullying the previous conversation by adding all of this online baggage to it. But thanks for listening. Take care. We'll talk to you next time.